You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
A te mari e, ko hana os toku ingoa, and welcome to this week's bits. This week, a report into the New Zealand mental health sector was released, which highlighted some serious concerns within the sector. New changes to immigration laws in hopes of decreasing the large migration figures also happened, and a recent publication titled The Best of I Tangata sparked up some discussion around Māori and Pacifica voices portrayed in the media. First, let's look into the report. So the report was titled The People's Mental Health Report, and it invited those with experiences in the sector to share their stories. 500 stories were submitted from both patients and staffs, and the report then looks at these stories and also contains four key recommendations based on the key themes raised in the stories that were given. 95BFM reporter Katie Doyle spoke to one of the report's contributors, Mike King, about the findings of the report.
Now I just want to discuss some of the findings of this report. 36% of the stories submitted were about accessing mental health and people needing to be at an absolute crisis point before being seen. What are your thoughts on this and what can be done to rectify this issue?
Well, let's make one thing perfectly clear first. This was there was an open call for people to submit their experiences with the mental health service, whether they were people accessing services or people who work in services. And you're always going to get people who have had a negative experience more motivated to answer that call. So we're not suggesting that any of these figures are indicative of mental health services. They're just giving us a broad outline of people's experiences. So 93% of people who responded to the call said that access was their primary problem with mental health service. The overriding theme was we're doing what everyone is telling us to do. We're picking up the phones. We're going to the computers. We're asking for help. But when we're doing that, the help's not there. I really believe that the government weren't prepared for, and the DHBs weren't prepared for the overwhelming number of people who would access that service when they put the call out.
And how do you think they should be more prepared?
Funding increases, number one, you know, to help frontline services cope with the overwhelming amount of people that are trying to access service. Number two, an independent inquiry into the mental health services as they stand right now. There's no point in trying to fix something when you don't know what's broken. So an independent inquiry, an independent commissioner, an independent oversight commissioner. Currently, the mental health system evaluates itself, and we know from experiences with the likes of the New Zealand Police, you need an independent complaints authority to give an unbiased view on people's complaints and people's needs, and finally education in schools.
Now, going back to the inquiry, if one was done tomorrow, for example, what would you hope to kind of achieve from that?
Better outcomes for vulnerable New Zealanders is the ultimate aim of everything. This inquiry shouldn't be seen as politically destabilising or anyone having a go at mental health services, because the fact of the matter is, for most New Zealanders, they have a very good experience once they get into the system. It's getting into the system that's the hard part. So I would like an inquiry to come back and report on what is working in the system and how we can replicate those services to provide a better service for people, what's not working in the system and how we can boost those services to make them more effective, and most of all, make help more widely available for vulnerable New Zealanders. A classic example of where the system is breaking down is I got contacted by someone this morning whose employee attempted suicide, and they got to this person at 1 o'clock this morning. They dropped them at the hospital to emergency services. At 3 o'clock that morning, 2 hours later, after a serious attempt at taking their own life, this person was dropped back at the employer's door. No one wanted to talk to them. They just dropped this person at the door and left. So if that's not a system that's overwhelmed, I don't know what is.
And that was Katie with Mike King. Jogo Bar then spoke to Labor leader Andrew Little about where we would be able to get the funding to fix the mental health sector.
In terms of a gap in our system, I know you have mentioned there's a $1.7 billion funding hole that requires filling. Where will this money come from?
Yeah, that's the underfunding of health services generally over the last 6 years. We've committed to restoring that over a period of time. It'll take us more than 3 years. And that's money that is available right now to the government. It's just a question of priorities. The government is collecting enough tax revenue to meet the need to start to restore that shortfall in health funding. But what I can say is that we will make mental health a priority. It's not just those first line services that you have for anxiety conditions, depressive conditions. It's also addiction services and things like that that we know that there's a huge unmet need for, and I want to see us doing better in those sorts of areas.
But you've also mentioned housing and education as priorities, and then on top of that, Labor spokesperson David Clark also said that you have no plans to raise taxes, so won't you just end up compromising these other priorities in order to fund the mental health sector?
No. If you look at last year's, the budget for last year, when the government does a budget, they do their projections 4 years out. They were at that time projecting, or at least they had unallocated expenditure of roughly $1.5 billion in each of the years, starting this year and the next 2 years. Even since then, the government's tax revenue has got better. They're now generating surpluses that are quite significant. And so I've been very careful to make sure that any commitment I make can be funded out of the government's existing tax revenue. And that remains the case. And actually, the kind of surpluses that are being achieved not only enable us to start to put back together some of the things that this government has underfunded, but actually to repay debt that it's run up and to resume contributions to the New Zealand Super Fund. So we will continue to do that. One thing I'm not promising is tax cuts, and I think that is going to be one of the points of debate about this election. There are some people who would say, oh, good, the government's generating a surplus, then let's do these tax cuts, because tax cuts usually only favour the already very wealthy, and there's not much in it for anybody else. But we've got these huge other areas where the government has reduced funding and underfunded, and we need to make sure that those gaps are not creating bigger social problems that cost us more in the future.
Right. 23% of the stories that made up that report also cited a massive strain on staff in the mental health sector. Is government-funded support a viable provision for them?
Yeah, I think that's about finding out where the gaps are. I think part of what's happening is too that people are, before they get access to mental health services, because they can't get the primary health care stuff and the community health support that they would ordinarily expect to have, they tend to be in a worse state by the time they turn up to a hospital, and that's putting a huge strain on staff. So that's why I think I don't want to make a whole heap of specific commitments about where we might sort of spend extra money, except I'm prepared to accept that we do need to spend extra money. What I do want to know is, and have a good picture of, is where those gaps are, and a plan that actually starts to fill in those gaps over whatever period of time we think we can do it realistically in.
And that was Jogai with Andrew Little. The New Zealand government has made some crucial changes to the immigration laws in the hopes of decreasing the record-breaking migration figure of 71,300 last year. Immigration Minister Michael Woodhouse announced the introduction of a salary threshold that aims to target low-skilled migrant workers. 95BFM reporter Kelly Enright spoke to the minister about this kind of controversial change. She asked what the changes would mean for migrants who are under the threshold already living here in New Zealand.
Well, there'll be no change to the circumstances that they are in now on. So, for example, if they have their partners and children here, that will continue, but they will be subject to the three-year limit. So if they've been here some time, they'll be able to stay for a maximum of 3 years. If they don't qualify for residence under the new threshold policies, then they'll also be required to comply with the stand-down period.
when these changes do occur and we see the threshold, you know, people not in low-skilled jobs not able to come over anymore, if there is those in high-skilled jobs coming over, will they automatically be able to bring their families and children, or is that changing
as
well?
Yes, they will, and I think it's also important to acknowledge that with the number of jobs that are being created in the growing economy, it will still be necessary, I think, in some industries and in some parts of the country for those lower skilled, lower paid workers to come in. They just need to be clear about the conditions under which they are coming and the time limits that apply.
So in terms of finding a balance in the intake of migrant, last year we saw, you know, more than 70,000 immigrants come in. Ideally, what number are you looking for?
Well, the first thing to say is that 70,000 number is on net migration. So that includes the movements of Kiwis and Australians. And it's also driven very strongly by the high number of working holiday makers that we have now. In fact, over the last few years, the number of people that have come in under labour market tested work visas has actually dropped quite considerably. So as for whether or not there's a target, or I can give you an estimate of the number, the drop that would occur in net migration, it's hard to tell. It'll depend on the sorts of decisions that they make. So, for example, if there are a large number of students coming in into Auckland, say, on sub-degree qualifications with an expectation that they could have a pathway to residence under the skilled migrant category, that's not going to be there for them. However, they may make different decisions. They may still come in and they may study different things that give them a better chance of staying. The number of people who come in with partners and children, that will also drop, but it's a little hard to estimate how much that'll be. I would say it's in the thousands, but we're not putting a target on it.
So those students that do come in and decide to maybe study in more high-skilled jobs, what's it going to look like for them going straight from studying and not being able to meet the threshold perhaps? What does that mean for them? Do they have to go back to their home countries?
They're still eligible for post-study work visas, and that will still be the case. But if they find themselves after 3 years in the situation where they haven't reached that threshold, yes, they will need to go home. They will be subject to that stand-down period.
And that was Kelly with Michael Woodhouse. A recent publication titled The Best of Itangata has sparked a discussion regarding the lack of Māori and Pacifica voices in mainstream media. 95BFM's Joke Barr spoke with one of the editors and founders of Itangata, Gary Wilson, to learn more about the magazine's mission to change just that.
It cited Itangata as providing some of the most incisive and profound commentary on life in New Zealand. Is this due in part because it draws on the thoughts and observations of people that don't necessarily receive the platform in mainstream media?
Well, I mean, it was kind of a flattering comment because, I mean, not all that we produce anyway is incisive and top quality. But yes, I think it stands out partly, or maybe even significantly, as you're suggesting, because as a rule, the mainstream media presents bugger all in that territory. I mean, it's not as if there isn't any focus on Maori and Pacific things, but there's no consistent coverage or sort of
mainstream coverage.
Yeah, thoughtful coverage in the mainstream. There's still much too much of a tendency to chase brown things when there's a, you know, a potential controversy or misbehaviour or whatever.
Mm.
I mean, no, and I don't believe that that's, you know, particularly, there's anything particularly evil in the intentions there. It's just that for quite understandable historical reasons, mainstream media is still staffed by people who don't know too much about things Maori or things Pacific.
So just touching on that a little bit more, we have Maori television providing shows like Mediatake and R&R with Robert Rakete, and then TVNZ's got Te Karere and Tangata Pacifica. Has there been a significant shift in the representation of brown perspectives in recent times, or do you think this is still very much considered a niche thing?
Oh, very, very niche, I think, and with not much reach. I don't know the figures for any of those programs, but, you know, I have heard some in the past, and, for example, Maori television, and it doesn't have big numbers. And, you know, to take Te Karere, for instance, or or Te Kaia, the news program on MTS. With them being in Maori, certainly they don't have much reach into a mainstream Pākehā audience. And that's not to say they don't have a value, but it's still, it's hard to think, maybe even impossible to think of any radio or TV Maori programs that have a significant reach.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the BCasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/BCasts.